Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. February 24th marked the third anniversary of the devastating Russian military assault on Ukraine. According to the UN Refugee Agency, as a result of heavy shelling and fighting, 3.7 million people in Ukraine have been driven from their homes and displaced internally, while 6.9 million more people have fled to neighboring countries like Poland, Hungary, and Moldova, and beyond. Missile and rocket attacks on Ukraine have caused widespread death, destruction of homes and businesses, and severe damage to critical infrastructure. More than 2.5 million homes across the country have been damaged or destroyed, leaving many Ukrainians in these damaged homes or in buildings that are ill-prepared for the life-threatening freezing temperatures that come during winter. And as the war continues, humanitarian needs are multiplying and spreading. Now, with all the U.S. coverage of Ukraine focusing on politics and Trump's relationship with Putin, there's very little discussion about how ordinary people in Ukraine have been able to endure 3 years of relentless Russian bombardment. So what is life like in Ukraine right now? Well, in her new book, Night Train to Odessa, our guest today, award-winning journalist Jen Stout, highlights the stories of ordinary Ukrainians fighting to survive and defend their country. She has vivid tales from the front lines, Ukrainian cities, and just everyday life amidst this Russian aggression against Ukraine. Jen Stout is an award-winning journalist, photojournalist, writer, and radio producer, and the author of Night Train to Odessa. Jen's work in Ukraine has been shortlisted for prizes by Amnesty International, the Foreign Press Association, and the Scottish Press Awards, among others. And Jen will also be discussing her book on Tuesday at 7 o'clock at Bird and Beckett Books in San Francisco. For more information, you could check out kalw.org. Jen, so good to have you with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, yeah, really congratulations on the book, and thank you for writing it and for your coverage to give us this perspective on life in Ukraine, and particularly, as I mentioned, just how everyday people are getting through the war there, their attitudes, their resilience. And so before we dive into the book, though, can you just give us a quick snapshot of what's happening in Ukraine right now? I understand you were just there in January.
Yeah, I was in Kharkiv in January, so it was around the time of the inauguration of President Trump. It was a funny trip, actually, because when I left the UK, everyone was saying, oh my God, what's going to be happening in Ukraine, you know, when Trump gets in? And actually, I spent the week in Kharkiv there, no one talking about him, no one talking about politics. We were busy with, my friend launched a poetry book, there was a great new sculpture exhibition, people doing art to explore, to try and explain the reality of like what their lives are really like. There's a kind of absurdity because there's so much normality, of course, you know, there's millions of people in these cities, and then there's so much abnormality. So even just like in the last few hours, there's been huge strikes in Kharkiv, very large number of people injured, and that's with cluster bombs. They're sending cluster bombs into blocks of flats. You cannot imagine the carnage that does.
Well, it's really striking in your book just how much, as you say, life goes on. People really try to maintain their resilience, maintain everyday life, even in the face of sirens and bombings. And I also wanted to ask you about some breaking news today. We know that President Trump has been pressuring President Zelensky of Ukraine, demanding control over Ukraine's resources and major concessions to Russia in exchange for the prospect of further continued U.S. support for the Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion. And then there's reports today that Ukraine has signed a minerals agreement with the United States. And we also heard from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who announced that the U.S. may have to abandon efforts to try to get a ceasefire in this conflict. So just based on your reporting, what do you think it seems to be happening right now? What do you make of these most recent events?
It's a pretty grim spectacle, to be honest, Ethan. The last few months of watching this play out, I think that Oval Office sort of performance, that bit of theatre, was very deliberately, it was kind of a bit of a power play, just to remind Ukraine that they need the US, to remind Europe as well, perhaps, that they need the US. So my real hope with this is that Europe finally steps up, that European leaders realize that there's a war in their continent, that they have to be involved, they have to have defense spending massively ramped up, because it's not just Ukraine, there are so many countries at risk here, particularly if there's a bad peace deal. And by that, I mean a peace that isn't a peace, you know, a frozen conflict where millions of people remain under occupation and there's no justice and accountability for the war crimes committed by Russia. That's not peace, really, is it? And it would only lead to further conflict. I was in Moldova quite recently on the way to Ukraine. That's a very small country that's kind of sandwiched in between Ukraine and Romania. It's still partially occupied by Russia from the 1992 war. And I think they're in real danger. You know, they're in real danger, just like the Baltic states where they're building defensive lines. So this is Europe's issue. I mean, you can agree with Trump on that sense that there hasn't been enough defense spending. There hasn't been a 5% sort of NATO requirement or even 2.5%. So yeah, a lot of my work does focus on the European context, and that's where my optimism lies. In terms of this mineral deal, I guess they have to sign it, don't they? It's hard to see how that will have any immediate effect. I mean, these things are very long term. They take years to have the kind of extraction that would lead to any profit. So it seems like that's a kind of politics by other means at the moment.
Well, Jen, you talk about the threats to the rest of Europe here. What exactly do you make of Russia's end game here? I mean, they're bogged down in Ukraine. It seems like this invasion and takeover did not go as quickly and seamlessly as they planned. What do you make and the people you talk to make of what Russia is trying to accomplish here and in terms of the threats to the rest of Europe, as you just described?
Yeah, it's something that Ukrainians will say all the time. Ukrainians tell me, we are fighting for all of Europe, if only Europe would understand that, would see that. It's really poignant. I mean, they see themselves as fighting, you know, for the territory of Europe, but also for like the principles on which the post-war European project was built, the rule of law, right? If there's no prosecutions for Russian war crimes, does the rule of law internationally even exist? Other dictators and tyrants will be looking at Russia and saying, right, so there's no consequences, hey? So we can just annex our neighbor's territory and commit genocide there without any consequence. Well, let's crack on. So I think that, yeah, this isn't just about Russia and Ukraine. And I think the thing to really understand is this is not just about territory for Russia. This is deeply ideological. So I was living in Russia before the full-scale invasion for about 3.5 months. I was in Moscow. I was actually in Siberia when the invasion started. And I watched that society kind of lose its mind. You know, and it'd been going on for a long time, but really people were it's so much propaganda hammered into them by the insane nightly TV debates or these propaganda hosts with this idea that Russia is under threat. Russia's constantly under threat. It's the victim. And all bullies say they're the victim, don't they? Because they need to justify what they're doing. But really, they've made this very clear over and over again. It's not just about getting some territory. They see the existence of Ukraine as a state, as an idea. They see that as an existential threat to their existence for some reason. And so I don't think they stop if they get a bit of Donbass, right? I don't think that will satisfy them. And about the rest of Europe and the threats to that, we've heard the same rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin about Moldova and about some of the Baltic states. So what they say is, oh, well, it seems that you have some Russian speakers there. Exactly the rhetoric that they used.
Jen, looks like we're losing you a little bit. We just cut out there. Are you still with us?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm still with you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, we heard you kind of intermittently there, but please do continue.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just saying that it's very ideological for Russia. Russia won't stop with some territorial gains. They want the end of Ukraine as a state. And they've been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you have to understand the colonial context to this. They've been banning the Ukrainian language, killing Ukrainian writers, and occupying Ukrainian territory for hundreds of years in one empire form or another, the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, the Russian Empire. This is the context of it.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jen Stout, award-winning journalist, photojournalist, writer, and radio producer. She's the author of Night Train to Odessa, a really harrowing first-person account, very gripping account of her time on the ground in war-torn Ukraine. And Jen, you talked about the threats to all of Europe and what Russia's ambitions might be in Ukraine. and beyond, but is the solution then for Europe to militarize? I mean, after World War II, the deal was that the U.S. would essentially be the national defense for Europe, and now the U.S. is retreating. So is that the solution now, militarization in Western Europe?
Well, I hate to say it, but sure. I think for a lot of people, I grew up in total peace and stability, and I took it completely for granted. And it was only when I went to Ukraine and I was seeing my friends, you know, joining the army or desperately trying to fundraise so that their uncle would have night vision goggles, I realized the army there is not some distant state thing. This is your friends, your neighbors, and they're protecting you from an occupation that would be truly horrific. So yeah, I think sometimes you have to fight. You know, this is about fascism, actually. Russia has become fascist, I think, and you do have to put up a fight to that. My worry is that Western Europe doesn't listen to Eastern Europe. It never really has done, and they really need to be aware of just the threats that are facing these countries that are bordering Russia and Ukraine, and act very quickly. I think there seems to be a real reluctance to face up to this on the part of, you know, say Germany and France and the UK. But I see a lot more action coming from like Scandinavian countries. I mean, Sweden and Finland have now joined NATO. And as I said, the Baltic countries, the Eastern countries, they're very aware of the threat. You know, they're building defensive lines. They're preparing for what might be, they think, 5 years down the line, a very resurgent and strong Russian army coming for another bite.
I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. If you have questions for Jen about what life is like in Ukraine right now, if you have questions about what the U.S., what people in the U.S. could be doing to try to change U.S. policy towards Ukraine, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions or comments that you might have at yourcall@kalw.org. Jen, we talked about your recent time in Ukraine back in January, and that during the Trump inaugural, that it wasn't really the main topic of conversation, but you referenced this Oval Office really showdown between Zelensky and Trump, where Trump and J.D. Vance were really berating Zelensky and taking Russian propaganda lines about how Ukraine started this war. That's been sort of Trump's line. It's really been echoing Russian propaganda. What are your sources in Ukraine saying about how the country and the people there now are viewing the United States and Trump specifically?
Well, I always try and be as Ukrainian as I can, and I try and embody their sense of humor. They have a very dark and very funny, dry sense of humor. And a lot of people would say to me, you know, we've been fighting for years. I mean, more than just the full-scale invasion, of course. It's been since 2014, 2013 with this. And this isn't going to set us back. This isn't going to stop them. They understand that it's an existential war for them. You know, Russia wants to wipe them out. It wants to destroy the idea of Ukraine and Ukraine as a nation. So they will keep fighting. If they've kind of had to do it with their hands tied behind their backs the whole way through, because the weapons that were promised sometimes didn't arrive because, you know, nobody wanted to give them Taurus missiles in case it upset Russia too much. So they've been, I think Ukrainians are used to being slightly abandoned. They're used to being talked down to. And this is obviously worse, what's coming out of the White House now.
Yeah, I think, Jen, you dropped out, I think.
I mean, stuff that Steve Witkoff here. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, have you got me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah. So I'm just saying what Steve Witkoff, the U.S. special envoy, has been saying, it's pure Russian propaganda lines. And you do hear this in society sometimes with people like Mayor Scheimer, sadly people like Noam Chomsky, completely misled, spouting stuff that's just completely untrue about Ukraine and about Russia. They don't seem to understand the basic facts about this. So, I mean, what we should remember as well, Russia annexed, it declared that there were certain parts of Ukraine, this is 2 years ago, 3 years ago, certain parts of Ukraine that were now Russian. These were certain oblasts or regions. Now, their negotiating position, as far as we know right now, is still that they want all of those regions, even though they don't occupy them fully. So they're expecting to get Zaporizhia city. That's a city of 400,000 people. Now, would any country in the world just hand that over to an occupying force, 400,000 of your own citizens, to an occupying force that rapes and murders, blacklists and torture. No, of course not. So it is really, really hard for me to see at the moment just what kind of peace deal can be achieved. And I don't think anyone is surprised that, of course, Trump couldn't do it in 24 hours or whatever nonsense he was saying.
You're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about what's happening on the ground right now in Ukraine in the face of Russia's invasion. We're speaking with Jen Stout, award-winning journalist and author of Night Train to Odessa. And Jen will be discussing this book on Tuesday at 7 o'clock at Bird and Beckett Books in San Francisco. And the phone lines are open if you have questions for Jen about what's going on in Ukraine, how people in Ukraine are dealing with this invasion, how they view the United States. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email any questions you might have to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, I want to go to the phone lines now. We have Tom in San Francisco dialing in. So, Tom, welcome to Your Call. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So one of the justifications for Putin's invasion of Ukraine was the protection of Russian-speaking populations in the eastern portions of Ukraine. And that those people were being oppressed by Ukrainian leaders or other, you know, non-Russian speaking peoples. So what is the reaction of those people to the invasion?
That's a great question, Tom. Yeah, how did the Russian speaking sort of Russian culturally identified perhaps Ukrainians, what are their take on this?
Yeah, I think there's a big misunderstanding about those people. So I've spent a lot of time in eastern Ukraine interviewing people who remain there. And so I've lost count of the number of people who would say to me, look, you know, they would get quite cross and say, please understand, I'm speaking Russian, but I am a Ukrainian. They were not Russian sympathizers. They didn't feel close to Russian culture, but they speak Russian language because of historical reasons, right? Because perhaps they're ethnically Russian from like their family having moved there 60 years ago, 100 years ago, whatever. There was a lot of cross-border movement. But they are Ukrainian people. They believe that they belong to the Ukrainian state, and that's what they've chosen. So them being lumped in as kind of Russian affiliated, it's always been quite unfair. The idea that these people were being oppressed by Russia, I mean, Russia even claimed that there was a genocide committed against them. It is factually wrong. It's just not true. It's just not true. And that has been the basis for Russia's war of aggression. Was a massive, great, big lie. There are things that you can cherry pick and say, oh, look at this, this is proof of it. But there, you really need like the context here. So a few years ago, there was a law brought in Ukraine that said that state officials, when they're conducting official duties, they should be speaking in the Ukrainian language. I think most countries would find that law quite reasonable. And there were some other laws about, like, you know, if you have magazines and newspapers should be at least published in both languages and not just Russian. And that might seem kind of like heavy-handed, but that is correcting literally centuries of Russian domination and of Russification. Like, if you wanted to get on in life, you had to speak Russian, you had to write in Russian, and they're correcting that. And I think, again, that kind of makes sense. But it was turned in and twisted into this whole, oh my God, the Russian language has been banned and these people are so oppressed, and it just wasn't true.
Well, I want to thank Tom for that question. And in your book, Jen, you were in Russia just kind of in the lead up to the war on a fellowship. And you talk about the common attitudes among everyday Russians that you encountered, really 100% buying this Russian propaganda and repeating some of the things you just mentioned, that the Ukrainians are committing genocide, that they're fascists, that they're Nazis. They didn't see their own country and Putin's regime as an aggressor in any way. Can you talk about what you heard on the ground while you were in Russia?
Yeah, it's a really grim aspect of this story. So of course I knew people in Russia who didn't believe that stuff, you know, but they've mostly left Russia. They left Russia at the beginning of the full-scale invasion and live in a kind of limbo in exile in various European countries. So many people I knew, yeah, they would, when I asked them their position, they would repeat lines from the TV. And I'd say, guys, can you tell me in your own words? And they couldn't. They'd just been honestly brainwashed. I don't think there's another word for it. over years and years and years of believing that, yeah, that Ukrainians are Nazis. Some of this is about the revolution of dignity in Ukraine in 2012-13. That was a democratic uprising against a deeply corrupt and pro-Russian president. I mean, this guy had like a palace full of gold. He had gold toilets. He was an absolutely classic corrupt tyrant. And when people rose up against him, people began to be shot by government forces. And that's when all the people started to join the students. And it became this huge, incredibly inspiring democratic revolution. Russia saw that as a threat to its own interests and called it a coup. It's not a coup, but that's what they called it. And ever since then, they've been trying to destroy Ukraine. And some of that is not allowing Ukraine to move from its sphere of influence. I think some of it's petty jealousy. You know, we saw there was a thing that soldiers were graffitiing on places that they were destroying in Ukraine. One of them said, "How dare you live better than us?" You know, and Ukraine had progressed a huge amount in the last kind of 15, 20 years, and they just didn't like that. So Russians really have, in my experience, a kind of an empire in their head. They have an imperialism, the same kind of thing you would have found British people saying like 50 years ago, right? Some people still do. We've dealt with it a little bit, where they say, well, yes, I mean, we did expand and we took over territories, but we brought them civilization. We brought them trains, whatever. And glossing over the violence and the brutality and the colonialism that of course, involved. Russians will tell you, we've never had any ethnic conflict in our country. It was nonsense, absolute nonsense. Of course there was. Huge amounts of brutality and deportations and conflict. So really, it's like how a society progresses and says, okay, we did some things that were very bad. You know, our society is built on brutality. And how do we now deal with that and progress forwards? In the UK, I think we've started to do that. In Russia, they've kind of gone backwards.
Well, this is Media Roundtable, so I have to ask you, what do you make of the media coverage of what's happening in Ukraine and Russia's invasion of that country?
As you said, yeah, it is very much in the abstract, isn't it? Quite recently, it's been so much about diplomacy or lack thereof, like a lack of civility almost. I think no one could fail to be just astounded by that Oval Office meeting, like the sheer rudeness of it. It was incredible to see a US president behave in that way towards a representative of 40 million people. I mean, that's who Zelensky represents, is all the Ukrainians, more than 40 million, to treat him like that was incredible. And of course, that's the focus of a lot of media coverage. But yeah, absolutely, there's a lack of Ukrainian stories now in the news. I mean, I told you earlier that Kharkiv has just been hit day after day, but even just a few hours ago, by a massive cluster bomb attack on residential flats, apartments. I mean, the people have died, children have died. And that's not really a headline anymore, because it happens so often. And because we got distracted, we got bored. That's how the media cycle works. I really hate it. You know, I think a lot of people find that very, very infuriating. I tend to do more kind of long form and contextual, like essays and longer pieces now, to try and put in some of the context to this and the history and explain this a bit more. But I know, I mean, there's a lot of people just still trying to do the daily news, the breaking news, and it's really, really tough if there isn't the appetite to hear it.
And you're really a great example of a war correspondent. I know from the book, you were sort of thrown into it, given that you were in Russia on a fellowship when the war broke out. But do you have thoughts about advice for being a war correspondent? What would be your message to the media and trying to get access to better stories out of Ukraine and other war-torn places?
Yeah, sure. No, it's a really good question. So because of like budget cuts and what's happened to media, there are fewer and fewer foreign correspondents, I think, on staff, and we're relying more on freelancers like me to get new stories from conflict zones. There's a huge problem with that, of course, which is not having any backup, not having perhaps insurance or as much safety as you'd have with an organization. It does also mean there's opportunities for people like me to go and tell these stories, and that's really great. But yeah, I speak to so many kids and they say, oh, I want to do what you do, and how do I do this? And I always say, like, you do the journalism first, right? Do a few years of reporting so that you've got that under your belt. Make sure you've got a language. Make sure you do the training. The hostile environment training is so important to try and have a modicum of safety when you go there. But I think the main thing is to have a bit of journalism experience, because when you go to a place like that, you're asking people to trust you. as a professional, you're asking people to tell their stories on what might be the worst day of their lives. And doing that as a kind of really fresh, you know, student or really, really young reporter, I think can be a bit questionable. But look, I mean, when I was going to Ukraine, as you said, I kind of fell into it. I'd been in Moscow, I ended up in Romania reporting on the border there. And a lot of people told me that I shouldn't go anywhere near Ukraine, that I didn't have the experience as a war reporter. But I mean, you do have to start somewhere, don't you? And I did my best to try and be cautious, be careful, to take my time and get as much training as I could before I went there. But sometimes you do have to follow your gut as well.
And when we're thinking about what's coming up next year, lots changing on the ground. We talked about the minerals deal and Secretary of State Rubio potentially backing out of ceasefire efforts. What are some of the big stories that you're anticipating coming up, and any other work that you have in the pipeline that you want to preview for us?
Sure. My focus really, as I said, is on Europe. So this is actually my first time in the US. It's been a wild trip so far. I'm talking to people about the book, but I'll be going back and probably focusing a lot on Eastern Europe. I want to write about Moldova, Romania. I mean, there is war in these countries in certain ways already because of the hybrid warfare that Russia commits, you know, the cyber stuff, the election interference, the political interference. I'm really going to focus on those places because I think what happens in Eastern Europe is probably one of the biggest stories in the world and in my lifetime. And that's all kind of live and happening right now in front of us. So I'll do a bit more book touring and then I'll be back on the road and reporting again.
Well, we look forward to that reporting. And for anyone who does want to talk to Jen in person, hear her talk in person, she will be discussing her book, Night Train to Odessa, on Tuesday at 7 o'clock at Bird and Beckett Books in San Francisco. Jen Stout, thank you so much for coming on to Your Call, for your great work reporting on this. Congratulations on the book again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about media coverage of Trump's tariffs and how those tariffs are going to be playing out in the U.S. economy and beyond. So stay with us here on Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back right after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what we have coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, now we're going to turn our attention to the ongoing saga of U.S. tariffs and their impact on the economy and working people in this country. Just a couple of days ago, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell told the Economic Club of Chicago that tariffs are highly likely to generate at least a temporary rise in inflation, noting that Trump's import taxes were higher than most forecasters had expected and that, quote, the inflationary effects could also be more persistent. There are also fears that the tariffs could lead to an economic recession and some indication that we're already seeing slowdowns at the ports and visitation from foreigners coming to the United States as tourists. So how are Trump's tariffs and these shifting tariff policies impacting the U.S. economy and the outlook for a potential recession? And how is the media covering this story? Well, we're joined by David K. Johnston to help us unpack what's happening here with tariffs in the U.S. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several books, including the most recent one, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is the founder of the nonprofit news service DC Report. So thank you so much for joining us, David.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. The most recent book, by the way, is The Big Cheat. It's my third book on Trump.
All right. Too many books for me to keep track of, but we'll definitely make a note of that. And I appreciate you mentioning that. I also want to let you, our listeners, know that we're opening the phone lines now. If you have thoughts about U.S. tariff policies, if you are personally affected by the tariffs, do you run a business that has been affected by tariffs, or has your consumer patterns been affected? What you're buying, what you're anticipating buying, how you're changing your finances potentially. We'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So, David, Trump's on and off tariff policy, mixed messages have been in the headline for the past few weeks, and no one really seems to know exactly where we're going with this, what the end game is, and it doesn't even seem like the president himself really knows. But before we dive in and talk about what's at stake, I just wanted to ask you, what do you think about how journalists are covering Trump's tariff policy at this point?
Oh, I think the coverage is sort of so-so. The fundamental problem in the tariff coverage is journalists seem to understand that when you tariff imported goods and therefore raise their prices, you're enabling domestic manufacturers of competing goods to raise their prices. And I'll give you a simple example. Imagine you own a car company and you sell cars wholesale out the factory door for $10,000 and you make a $1,000 profit on each car. Donald now puts a 60% tariff on Chinese cars. Well, they're now going to sell for $16,000. You're not going to keep your price at $10,000. You're going to raise your price to $15,000. So you're still cheaper than the Chinese car. You're going to make a profit now, not of $1,000, but $6,000 a car. Now, you'll probably sell fewer cars because people can't afford them. But even if you sell only half as many cars, you'll make three times as much profit. Donald's tariff scheme is designed to extract money from the vast majority and redistribute it to the very narrow class of people who own manufacturing enterprises.
And do you think the media really misses that point? Is that the critical point, or is there something that the media should be doing better to cover
the
story?
That's the single most important point that I think has been missed. For a number of weeks, I couldn't find any references to this. I finally heard a few, but I monitor all three network news broadcasts in the evening, and there wasn't a single report that talked about this. But I'm now beginning to see a few reports, mostly by columnists like Catherine Rampell, pointing out, often without, I think, enough specificity, that tariffs benefit domestic manufacturers by helping them to raise prices. Now, on a broader level, a political level, you know, we're turning friends into enemies. We're leading people to distrust doing business with us. And we've opened the door to something that would be devastating to the American economy. That would be for the EU, the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand to form a free trade zone. And even if they allowed China and Japan in on a limited basis, not as full partners, but some limited basis, all of those countries together could just make us essentially irrelevant in a lot of trade, costing us dearly. And all of this, frankly, because Donald doesn't understand what a tariff is. He thinks it's a tax on the country that's being tariffed. It's not. It's a tax on American consumers, whether they're individuals or businesses buying business tools from overseas.
Well, we're talking to David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of a number of books. He's also professor of practice teaching law, public policy, and journalism at Rochester Institute of Technology. And I want to welcome another veteran political reporter to the program as we're talking about U.S. tariff policies, how it's being covered by the media, and what its impact is on and will be on the U.S. economy. I want to welcome Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation and a contributing editor at The Baffler. He was formerly editor of The Baffler and New Republic, and the author most recently of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Chris, welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thanks much. Pleasure to be here. So Chris, I should also note that I lived in Rochester for my graduate career, so we have that connection as well.
Yeah, we've got a Rochester reunion here, so this is great. Not intentional, but wonderful to hear. So, Chris, I was asking David about media coverage of the Trump tariff policies. I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on that too. How do you see media covering it, and where are the things that the media is doing right, but where could the media be doing a better job?
I first of all want to second everything that David was saying. I think, you know, there's a big conceptual problem here, and it boils down to tariffs do function as a tax on consumers. And every time, you know, every time I've seen coverage in my hometown paper, the Washington Post, and other mainstream news outlets, you know, tariffs are treated as this exotic thing that, you know, were a big deal in the late 19th century. You know, so first of all, tariffs are ongoing. They've long targeted some industries that are in competition with American industries. I think the other huge gap I've seen in the coverage is, you know, there's all of this talk of, you know, it's basically accepting the very poorly thought out framework that Trump puts forward in making his case for tariffs, saying that, you know, there's going to be this vast economic renaissance, there'll be a resurgence in American manufacturing. And tariffs, you know, given that we are, you know, sort of 40 years into a sort of hyper global economy, that claim just makes utterly no sense. You know, every supply chain, including famously Elon Musk's electric car empire, relies heavily on Chinese labor, Chinese material, and that is true across most industries. You will see, you know, as David was indicating, there are industries that will enjoy a kind of tariff carve out under the Trump plan. And I think that's the other thing to note. We've already seen reports, you know, that Trump has exempted electronics manufacturing and sort of high tech gadgets from his punitive China tariffs. And that's the other huge thing to keep in mind, is that it's, you know, apart from not understanding the basic economics, Trump is drawn to tariffs as a tool of crony capitalism, which is how he views the world, which is how he has operated in the world since he came up in the New York real estate scene under the tutelage of Roy Cohn in the 1980s. The mafia is kind of his model for accomplishing things in the world. And so we're already seeing in this, you know, sort of very, what looks to be a really slapdash effort to, you know, forestall a massive global economic crisis and, you know, make allowances for industries in Donald's circle that are protected. That's going to be the model going forward. It's a system of economic reward and punishment that ensures that rewards will go disproportionately to people on the inside, crony class.
And let me go to David on that. David, what is your thoughts about Chris's point here about the crony capitalist aspect of these tariffs, the sort of personal deals for companies and countries that Trump and his family are able to make, and certainly make in terms of his political career as well, getting contributions, business, et cetera?
Well, Chris is exactly right about this. And what one of the things that plays into this is this theory of the unitary executive, that everything in the executive branch is under the direct control of the White House. So if you have a supposed commission or board that the law typically says has to have members of both parties, once you go to the unitary executive theory, what you're doing is saying, well, corruption is wide open, because the president can say this company will be exempt from the tariff, that company will pay the tariff, there's no difference between them except one has put money in Donald's pocket, bowed down to Donald, or done him some favor. And that's what you're seeing with his extortion of the big law firms and his successful extortion of Columbia University. Fortunately, led by Harvard, other universities are standing up to this. But at the center of all of this is Donald's belief, you know, that he is special, that no one else is capable or competent to be president, never has been. And unless you let him do whatever he wants, there will be no more America. There's no more country. We won't have a country anymore. If he were not president of the United States and were saying these things, I would tell you that Donald suffers from delusions of grandeur. But given that he's in the White House again, it's a little hard to make that argument.
Yes, he's still delusional, but he has the grandeur part down.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that is beyond dispute. So you're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're talking about U.S. tariff policies. It's on again, off again. It's up, it's down. And we're joined by two veteran political journalists, Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, and David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several books, including The Prosperity Tax, A New Federal Tax Code for the 21st Century Economy. And we'd love to hear from you as well. What are your thoughts about the tariffs? Are they impacting your bottom line? Are they changing your outlook for your business or for your own finances? The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, I wanted to ask you both, and Chris, maybe I'll start with you on this, about the sort of, because you brought this up, Chris, so this is part of why I'm asking this question in one of your recent articles. You talked about the Reagan coalition from 45 years ago, how the conservative movement has been a marriage of convenience between the GOP's traditional moneyed elite, but then a sort of a populist base of culture warriors. And now it seems that these tariffs have run the risk of potentially fracturing that coalition. Now, working class voters tend to take a more dim view of free trade, whereas the moneyed elite are the ones that are often benefiting from free trade, lower prices, being able to sell their goods abroad and accessing cheap labor, less environmental standards in other countries where they could manufacture their goods, et cetera. So, Chris, just starting with you on that, and then David would like to hear you weigh in as well. What do you think about the potential for this issue to create a fracture in that old Reagan GOP coalition?
Well, I think, you know, that political outcome is, you know, it would take time. And we have a very, you know, we have a Republican political party that has ceased to function democratically. So the feedback loops are kind of broken that would normally produce immediate consequences for this kind of disastrous policymaking. But it is notable, you know, that Trump walked back the tariffs the moment it was very clear the markets were rejecting them, you know, on a catastrophic scale. So that, you know, it's sad that this is, you know, a minimal bar that a president has to clear of, you know, arresting a completely self-created global economic crisis. But he did it. At least for, you know, this 3-month breathing period. And I do think the broader cracks in the coalition, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen in 3 months. And as David was indicating earlier, the sheer uncertainty created for investors and Wall Street by this, you know, chaotic approach to policy is itself a driver of economic and a potential economic downturn. So I do think, you know, and the other thing I mentioned in that piece you quoted from is that a nonprofit group associated with the Federalist Society, which is, you know, a conveyor belt for right-wing policy and law in particular, is mounting the first major court challenge to the tariffs. And that's a pretty interesting development, I'll just say. I it's far from clear how it'll play out, but the Federalist Society was completely in bed with the Trump administration during its first term, you know, famously told him which three Supreme Court justices to appoint during that time, has packed, you know, the rest of the federal bench with right-wing ideologues. The Federalist Society also significantly benefits from the single largest trust donation in the history of nonprofits from this billionaire manufacturer, as it happens in Chicago, literally gave them $1 billion. And so, yeah, these, you know, that's another thing that Trump just, I don't think, really understands about this. And it also applies to his, you know, David also referenced his rolling crusade against, universities, private law firms. These are all institutions that have deep connections to the conservative world. Mm-hmm. So if you start, he's threatening a new round of executive orders that will putatively roll back major sort of subventions to nonprofit foundations and groups. And there are tons of those on the right. I live in Washington. You know, libertarianism would not exist as a political force without the Koch brothers. That is just simply true. It is that they are a full employment plan for libertarian policy hands, I'll say. There's well, another word well beginning with AKA I was going to say, but anyway, I do think over the long term, you know, free trade is pretty central to our model of capitalism. There are things wrong with it, absolutely. And I don't, you know, I don't, I'm not a doctrinaire free trader. I acknowledge that there are, you know, situations where tariffs can be useful in a, you know, controlled, limited way. But you have to not make up numbers. And you have to not, you know, use them as, you know, as I was saying earlier, the basis for basically personal vendettas.
Well, David, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too. Are we going to see, you know, some real political fractures, or are things like the tax cuts for the wealthy that Trump and the Republicans in Congress are trying to push through, is that, and some of the deregulatory agenda, is that enough to make up for, you know, if you're a wealthy business person in this country, for potential losses in the stock market and, you know, other benefits you might get out of a free trade situation, which is going away with these tariffs?
Well, I just saw a survey in which Republicans were asked, do you regret your vote for Donald Trump? And only 1% do. So he's still holding very solidly onto those people who supported him last fall. There's enormous contradictions here that the Democrats seem utterly incapable of exploiting. For example, if the biggest threat we face is this national debt of 30-some trillion dollars, why would you continue the tax cuts for those at the top, which you're going to finance with borrowed money and cuts to ordinary people? By cutting, let's take the National Oceanographic Administration and Atmospheric Administration. When you cut their budget, contractors who rely on NOAA data say, well, we're going to start pouring concrete on this day, not that day, based on weather projections. What are they going to do? The costs of that will be enormous. The shorter time to warn people to board up your building or get out of there, those are going to be deadly. At the Internal Revenue Service, the cuts are so severe that the government no longer has money for expert witnesses. If you have a large tax case, the government may well have to bring as expert witnesses to show you were cheating on your taxes, and I'm talking about civilly, not criminally, engineers, biologists, historians. I mean, the IRS employs a huge number of people in these fields and many others, and the budget for all that's been cut to, I'm told, $1 per case. And that's not a tax return. That's a case where they found tax evidence of tax cheating and want to take you to court because you disagree and won't pay. You know, the object here has been always to burn down the government. That's why the second book in my Trump trilogy was called It's Even Worse Than You Think. And in this administration, surrounded by zealots, some of whom are highly competent managers, whereas Donald's an utterly incompetent manager, they are in the process of destroying the government as we've known it. And I don't think you're going to see, Ethan, a serious reaction to this. And I hate to say what I'm about to say, but it's just the brutal truth. When some poor women in the red states who depend on Medicaid find out that their eight-year-old child is going to die because of Medicaid cuts, when people discover that grandma, who'd been buying insulin thanks to Joe Biden for $35 a month, now has to spend $1,000 and she only has a $2,000 a month income and she's going to die. When businesses say, well, to plan and project for our investments in the coming year, we need data from census or labor or the IRS, and they don't have it. All of those are the things that are going to turn people around. And the biggest one will be when Social Security checks don't arrive. Now, Michael Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, who is a billionaire, you know, said that, well, if my mother didn't get her check, she would just say, oh, they probably made a mistake. We'll get one next month. And the people who call to complain, you know, they're the frauds. There's no fraud of any significance in Social Security. The reason it has birth dates of 150 years ago is once a code in the COBOL system of software says a birth date more than a certain number of years old, I think it's 115 or 116, no payments go out. It's a very cheap way to prevent fraud, but a lot of people now believe, oh my goodness, there's this trillions of dollars being stolen. Well, when old people don't get their checks, maybe me, since I'm on Social Security.
Yeah, that could lead to the implosion there of the Republican
and
policies.
They say, oh, I'm sorry, it'll be a year and a half till we can call you back, sir.
Right. Yeah, so the backlash potentially from these policies, and we're just almost out of time. So, Chris, I just want to end by giving you the last word here, which is, you know, David hinted at what the political future might be, but what else could be done? Are there opposition strategies that could be put in place? We've seen Senator Sanders and AOC at the forefront with big rallies. What do you see the opposition party doing in the wake of these economic policies, tariffs, and as David mentioned, the instability around basic social services?
Well, not enough. You know, you saw Chuck Schumer instantly cave on, you know, that was the moment the Democrats had leverage in Congress, was when there was another battle over funding the government. And Schumer just folded like a cheap suit. And
right on.
And we are, this directly affects DC, where I live, because the one concession he allegedly got was to claw back $1 billion in DC's municipal budget, which is run by Congress. And that appears also to have vanished. as far as I can tell, there are, you know, very little signs that the GOP Congress is going to restore that funding. Yeah. It's also worth noting, apropos of the tariffs, that Congress could stop this at any time. Congress
Chris, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but we're out of time. But you're absolutely right on that last point. And I'm sorry that we don't have more time. We'll have to bring you both on back to this program. There's so much to cover. Chris Lehman, DC Bureau Chief for The Nation, thank you so much for joining us. And David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter, I just want to thank you both for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ethan. Take care.
And as I said, hope to have you both back on, a lot more to cover. But that's our show for today. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also follow us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show, and Tariq Ansari is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.
Have you downloaded the new KALW app?